foothills of Ruapehu in Tongariro now, in the small town of Ōwhango, where our next guest, Hone Smythe, can usually be found trekking through the bush on horseback. Hone runs Horsam Trails, taking riders of any ability on spectacular treks through central New Zealand's backcountry. He's ridden and trained horses for most of his life and knows the local region like the proverbial back of his hand. More recently, he's begun to explore the power of equine therapy for people struggling with their mental health. Hone is well aware of the healing nature of horses that have guided him through his own ups and downs in life. He's now putting his life experience behind a new project, working with prisoners at Tongariro Prison, and he's hoping one day that can involve inmates working with local kaimanawa horses. I asked Hone to explain the business.
Horsam Trails is a horse trekking company that I started way back in the early 90s, 92, 93. And we've had a few rebranded of names over the years. So I've initially started off with Whakanui I te mana o te waione, and that was a bit of a handle for our overseas tourists to grasp. So then we changed to Horse Tracks to the Max, and that stayed for a few years. And then just in the last 5 years, we've rebranded again to Horsam Trails, just shortening it down. So we virtually have taken horse trekking to another level. So when I started horse trekking, I went out and done a lot of other people's horse tricks, and the feedback I was hearing from the clients on the tricks were that this was boring, and are we going to do anything else, or are we going to go up there? So I didn't want to be that sort of horse tricking operation, so I've sort of taken people out of their comfort zone, and I've gone into the Tongariro Forest here and our local forestry blocks, and I've opened up a lot of the old logging tram tricks. So it gives you a different level of riding. So you virtually get to experience the horse full on, exactly, you know, what it can do, where it can go. And we've sort of gone away from the single file and flat paddock and stay safe. Well, we always stay safe, but, you know, stay in single file lanes, and we've more or less gone away from the mamby-pamby of horse tricking, and we've added a lot more adventure and experiences that you can get along the way.
Well, look, this is such a beautiful part of the country, the foot of two mighty maunga. You know, beautiful, beautiful district, the Central Plateau. So, yes. You know, if someone comes out with you, what will they see? And then tell me a little bit more about the actual riding itself, because we're used to just going along, you know, just literally the horse walking. What can you achieve in a short time safely with clients? Just sort of take me on a little virtual trip with you.
Yeah, so basically a lot of my clients were overseas. People come from, you know, all around the world. And with COVID, that sort of just shut us right back. So they would turn up. 9 times out of 10, it was a partner, two partners, you know, girlfriend and boyfriend. The girlfriend had already gone and done all the mountain biking and mountain climbing and rafting with her partner. And then it was her turn to choose something to do in New Zealand, and she wanted to go horse tricking. So she'd bring her partner, who was terrified of horses, usually the case, the men. Men are terrified of horses because they've got no control. There's no throttle to accelerate. There's no brake to stop, so no steering wheel to steer. So they're really quite skeptical about horse riding. So I'd have to encourage them to get on a horse and then take them on sort of a tour around, but I'll incorporate the light stuff first. So I'd take them by the forestry road. So it just gives them a bit of time to settle down and ride some safe open tracks. And then I'll take them a bit up top on the forestry into quad bike, motorbike tracks and access for, you know, hunters and people on quads. So that gives you a different level of riding. So you've gone from middle road to mud track road. And then I'll usually finish it off by coming down through the deer trails in the actual bush itself. So you're riding amongst the flora and fauna, following the deer tracks and the old logging tracks that they used to log back in the 50s and 60s up here in the forest. And then we usually finish off with a river crossing, a big river crossing, the Whakapapa River. So they sort of get three levels of riding. You know, you start off into, you know, beginner, intermediate, then you're into the experienced stuff. And I've never had an accident. I've never had a mishap over those pretty much 30 wow. years that I've been doing it. So, yeah, it's a totally different way of what we've done with our horse tricks.
Yeah, deer track sounds one step up from a goat track, so I'm visualising that.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
this is about the animal, of course, and trusting the animal because, you know, you've not necessarily got perfectly trained and experienced riders. And I want to just explore a little bit more your connection with horses and what drew you to working with horses.
Yeah. So when I was a kid, a lot of the places that I was staying at, so I was from a broken home and I was, you know, given to different families to look after and stay with for various amounts of time. All these families were farmers, farming families. And back in those days, so this was back in the 70s, you know, motorbikes and that weren't really the normal for farmers. They were all horseback farming country. And so basically, if you didn't ride, you had to stay home with the lady of the house and do the chores around the house. So that definitely wasn't me. So we were chucked upon a horse and with just a saddle blanket and a rope with a bridle. And then we would go out with the uncle farm on the farm all day, and you pretty much learn how to ride straight away. You know, hang on, you know, lean forward, going up, lean back, going down, all this sort of stuff. And you pick it up really quickly, and you learn to use your legs. And then me being a young kid, I could actually see where the horse, what the horse could do, where the horse can take you, and that fascinated me. So I became addicted to horses from a young age, and that was the draw for me was what they could do for us and where they could take us.
They were a passage to adventure and a passage to new things.
Definitely, yeah.
But the relationship you have with them, if I could call it that, some people have described you as a bit of a horse whisperer, but how do you describe it, and what is it, the connection that a human can have with these animals?
Yeah, I've had a little bit of time to reflect on that. I think the beauty of it is the understanding between animal and human that you can get. It's very similar to having a dog. You know how you have your dog and you can, you know, teach your dog to do things. Well, you can do the same with horses. But I find horses to have a deeper, meaningful understanding of us as human beings. And they can read us really well. So they pick up on a lot of stuff that we carry. I don't know if that you can get what I'm saying, but they have like a sixth sense that they know when you're sad, they know when you're happy, they know when you're grumpy, you know, they know when you're having a bad day, and that transfers into them. And then they'll just take that on board, but they're very non-judgmental. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but
there's one lovely story, Hone, that talks about the actual literal communication, and you tell it, it happened about 10 years ago on the trek, some of the horses were just taking advantage of having the young kids on, you know, stopping to eat and just do their thing.
Yeah.
And what was it you learned from what happened when you, you know, took some action and did a bit of growling? What did you learn?
Yeah, so with taking your kids, you know, the horses do take advantage of them when they don't know what they're doing and they haven't got the strength to pull their heads up when the horses are eating. So I always had one lead horse that I would ride, and this horse would just be a no-nonsense, do the drill. She knew the drill. And so Bonita was her name, and she was my lead horse. So quite often I'd get families, and then the mother and father would be riding along nicely because they got the energy to heal the horse, you know, keep it moving. But the kids would be having a bit of problems because the horses were taking advantage of them and just going to eat along the sides of the tracks. So I'd turn around on my horse, Bonita, and go back and I'd, you know, give the horse a bit of a, come on, pick your head up, get up there, you know, give them a little bit of encouragement. And all this time over these years, I was thinking that it was my voice that was making them pick their heads up and catch up to the other horses. But it was only within the last 10 years or so that I noticed that my horse, Bonita, was relaying the message through horse talk, so to speak. So her ears would go back, and once that horse saw her ears go back, they knew that they were doing something out of line, And so she's the pack leader, and they would listen to her rather than to me. So then I finally clicked that it was up to me to look after the people and leave my horse to look after the horses. Huh. Yeah, it was pretty cool how it worked out like that.
It's been a full and interesting life you've had as an adult. I know you were a really good rugby player. You went to St Stephen's and were a really good rugby player, including some overseas experience and semi-professional. And yeah. You know, what was the life journey that brought you to this point of starting the trekking business and having, you know, a heart for wanting to get people out into nature?
Yeah, so when I sort of, my career sort of came to a bit of a crashing end, I actually broke my neck against Otago down in Carisbrook back in 1988. And that sort of rocked my world because, like most young aspiring rugby players, I was heading for that black jersey. And that sort of just crushed it. And I come home to rest and to just recuperate and get myself together and, you know, try and understand what I was going to do from here. My dream of being an All Black was sort of much over. I come home and I've probably done the opposite than what the doctors told me to do. So they told me I'd never play again, to live a life of protection around your neck. So I ended up coming home. First thing I'd done was I brought me a horse. I swapped the three-piece seat for a horse and saddle from this farmer. Broke it in, got it going, and then I just started riding. And it was therapeutic for me to get out there in the bush and have my own horse, and to go and camp up and sit by a fire. It was just therapeutic, and the wairua of the mahere of the bush was just beautiful, captivating to me. And then I realised that I could be sharing this to other people. So I more or less started off sharing it with a lot of my ex-rugby mates that I was playing with up in the counties and in South Auckland. They would come down and stay with me, and I'd take them out on horseback. Yeah, I just started seeing that I could do this for a living and for something that I really enjoyed, and yeah, became passionate about it. So that's pretty much where it started, really.
Over time, how has that developed into working particularly with young people?
So when I, so this area that I live in, it wasn't really a tourist attraction back in the day when I come home. So I had to attract people to come. And I sort of quickly learnt that a lot of the schools came to the mountain to experience the snow. So I needed to tap into that market of the schools. So I started, I had a typewriter back in those days, and I just typed letters, and I went through the yellow pages and found all the schools, and I just typed letters and sent them letters of inviting them to come and do a horse trick with me and what I can offer. And it more or less took off from there. They started coming. Then once I started getting a few of the schools, a lot of them were mentioning that this would be great for the alternative education kids. So the alternative education is the kids that don't really connect to being in a classroom, but they connect to being hands-on outdoors. And then it eventuated that we started getting those kids coming down to us. And then it evolved into the kids that were like, how do you say, in special needs groups. A lot of the police force were, had groups of children that they would, you know, take around and do activities with. So we started getting those children that were needing a lot more hands-on and a lot more care and nurturing through the life, you know, through the rough lives that they've had. So quite a few of these kids come from South Auckland, from Wellington, Whanganui. And that really was something that we really connected to, was these kids, because both myself and Terence Mananui, who started this whole venture with me, had been through, you know, rough times as children. So we really connected to these young kids. And the great thing about it was having them come to us as these little gangsters from the city, spending 4 or 5 days with us way up in the back blocks of the bush, where they were totally out of their comfort zone, and then watching them slowly transform back to children. That was, yeah, the reward of the whole journey was doing those kids back then. It was a really special time.
Your friend and business partner passed away, so that chapter came to an end.
But yeah.
Equine therapy, pretty widely accepted practice now. You're not a trained therapist as such, but it's an area that's interesting, you know, it continues to interest you. And can you talk a bit more about what you've been looking into recently about the link between horses and mental health? Like, working with the kids, you can see the horses were one thing, but the experience of being away, you know, with two mature, caring men, also with sufficient, I'm sure, boundaries for these kids as well. But you can see how that whole experience gave them some room and their nervous systems some room. But what are you looking into now in this more recent work about the link between horses and mental health?
Yeah, see, I've had a tragic experience 2 years ago with my daughter. She took her life, and that really rocked me. So it's really opened my eyes to people suffering. And then with a lot of my ex-rugby playing mates, they got to the height of their careers, and then it was cut short. Like for me, it was injury. But for other guys, it's been relationship breakups, can't get along with coaches. You know, there's been a whole lot of aspects of people, how they have the issues, and it all leads back to their mental well-being at the end of the day. So that really, my daughter's passing, taking her life, was, you know, that really rocked me, and it made me realise that people really need help. It's, the ways of the world have changed, and the strength of people has sort of weakened, I believe. And I think technology has a lot to do with that, because it's taken away our ability to just go and do things. It's harder now. And I think people really struggle with that. I know I struggle with it. And so I've sort of, incorporated what I do with the horses and opened the invitation to people to come to me who have these issues, and let's just go and settle up, get out there and clear your whole mind and your thoughts, and just reconnect with nature, and then restart what you want to do.
Kia ora, hone. Macharaha, ngā mihi nui.
Kia ora koutou.
Hone Smythe is our guest, and we are talking about his incredible connection with horses. He runs Horsham Trails, taking riders of any ability out on spectacular treks. As you're hearing, he's also long been involved in working with young people and people facing any number of life challenges by getting them out into the beauty of the bush and that very special connection with the horses. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. You now also have a new role, Hone, as pautautoko, mentor for Manaaki Ora, working with inmates. And how is this working?
I haven't actually started the role, and probably with COVID lockdown that we're in now might make that a bit further on down the track. But I saw an ad in the paper for Manaaki Ora, and they wanted to discuss, you know, it was all about mental well-being and drug rehab and that. So I decided to go along and just have a listen, because I've been unemployed for a while now, just doing various jobs here and there, driving, but nothing full-time. And I wanted to get back into the workforce, and obviously with the borders being closed, it's just shut the trekking right back. So I went to this meeting. They had all these chairs set up in a hall, and only 4 of us turned up, so it was a bit of a flop for them. And they were contemplating on not having the meeting when only 4 of us turned up. And I was like, well, I've travelled from Taumaranui, so this meeting was in Turangi. So they were like, oh, okay, so we sort of need to have this meeting, you've come that far. And then once they started talking about it, I could relate to everything they were saying. So they were talking about our inmates and how they were going through mental health and drug rehab, and you know, I can relate to that. And then I was just like, I've been there, done that. What you're telling me, I've experienced. And they're like, oh my God, have you got any medical practitioner, clinical practitioner skills? Or, and I said, no, but I've worked with a lot of young people who have gone through mental health and issues with their lives. They're like, oh, would you be interested in applying? I said, yeah. They said they had 6 positions available. I said, yeah, I would be. I said, I'm unemployed at the moment, so I'm open. So they sent me the application forms, and it had all this stuff in there about, you know, what degree do you have and where did you practice, da da da. And I'm like, oh, hell, I haven't done any of that. I'm a hands-on person. So I just more or less told them in my cover letter that I've been there, done that, and the life experiences that I've experienced you can never get from a university or in a college. And they sort of took that on board. And then 2 weeks later, I get a phone call asking me to attend an interview at Rangipo Prison. And I went to the interview, and they were pretty strict and full-on with it. But at the end of the day, they realized that I could relate to these inmates because of my life experiences. And then they wanted 3 references. I gave them 3 references. My references gave them glowing reports. 2 days later, I get a phone call. Welcome to the team. We're not hiring you as a clinical practitioner, but we're going to create a position called Pau Tautoko, where you will support the clinical practitioners. And in over 2 years, we will put you through all the papers that you need to become a clinical practitioner. So it's been a win-win situation for both of us, I feel, and I start that new position on Monday.
What a brilliant innovation, and isn't it good to see this finally coming in parts of the justice system, whether it's the arts, whether it is people reconnecting culturally, or in this instance, using someone's lived experience, but as we said earlier, also just the space that these kinds of ventures can offer people who are hurting, and as I said, people whose nervous systems are wired up to the max. Yeah. It's great to see the innovation. Kia ora, and all the best for it. Yeah, you also took your work with horses into the film industry too. You were involved in a number of film productions, including The Hobbit. And what sort of work were you doing there?
So in all the, I've done three movie jobs. The Hobbit was the last one, but prior to that I'd done The Warrior's Way, which was down in Wanaka, Kajrana. So that was about the Mammoth Hunter. And the main actors in there were Cliff Curtis or Uncle Bully. And so, yeah, that was my first look into the movie scene. And, oh, it was great, fascinated. And we had this horse master there called Peter White, who was from the UK. And prior to that movie, there was another one that I had been asked to go to, but I didn't go, and that was The Last Samurai over in Taranaki. And I was full on sharing at that time. And I was like, oh, I don't want to be in the movies. It's a fantasy world, blah, blah, blah. But when my mates come back from that movie, I had given them some horses. They sold my horses and come back with $6,000. And I was like, oh, my God, because I would only sold those horses for maybe $500. And then I was like, well, and they were like, oh, mate, you get good money in the movie industry. And I'm like, far out. Well, it sort of blew me away. And I was like, oh, so what are you going to do now? And they go, oh, we're off to Tauranga. We're going to go and buy a horse truck. I was like, wow, So it sort of gave me an insight on how much money they were making in the movies and the fun that they were having. And then when they reiterated a bit more about it, and I said, well, keep me in mind for the next one. And then the next one was that Warrior's Way. So I went down and then I experienced it. And then I was captivated by it straight away. It was just a beautiful industry to work in. Yeah, but unfortunately, along the way, other people step into the head role, the animal wrangler, head animal wrangler or horse master. And then those people sort of, the first guy that I experienced, he was brilliant. But the second guy that I experienced, he wasn't.
Well, now you've spoken up, I understand, where there's been animal issues on sets. Is that correct?
Yes. Not actually on set. It was in the housing and the husbandry of the animals.
Right.
So we lost quite a few animals on the Hobbit, like 27 animals I buried. And told to shut my mouth, don't say nothing. And then they would just get more animals in that looked like them. And it got to the point where I just felt this was wrong. And then it got to the point where I started butting heads with the horse master. And in that industry, there's a long line of people waiting to come in, so they can just walk all over you, get rid of you, and bring someone else just at the click of fingers. So that's virtually what happened. I stood up too much for the animals, and I stood up too much to what was happening. And what I could see from my experiences of being on a farm, and they didn't like it, so they fired me from my position. But what got me was they tried to actually blame me for what happened to the animals. And then that's when I started speaking up about what actually went on.
Were things ever resolved? Was there any kind of inquiry that resolved what went on?
There was an inquiry. It was an in-house inquiry. So once Pepper came on board, that really ramped everything up. And then before I knew it, my face was on a billboard all around America on all the big papers and that. But here in New Zealand, it wasn't being covered because it was all about Warner Brothers, John Key, allowing the movie industry, you know, tax deducted into New Zealand, and the New Zealand movie industry, and Sir Peter Jackson. So, but once Peter stepped in, it really amped it up. And then, so I was invited down to Wellington by Fran Welsh, Peter Jackson's wife. Lovely, lovely lady. So herself, Pippa Boyens, Caroline Cunningham, and Zane Wiener from Warner Brothers. We sat for about 4 hours just discussing everything that I spoke up about. And they'd done their own independent inquiry investigation after SPCA had done their investigation. And then SPCA come back to them and said that everything I had said was a lie. Nothing went down like that. There was a couple of chickens that got killed, but all the stuff he's talking about is wrong, and it's a case of a disgruntled employer. So they then done their own investigation, and their other wranglers spoke up and supported what I had said and confirmed that what I had said was true. So they got back to me after a few weeks, invited me back down, but I just said, just tell me what's happening over the phone. So Caroline Cunningham told me that the wranglers had supported what I'd said and confirmed that everything I'd said happened, and that the horse master that was in charge will no longer be involved in the movie industry again. So that was the outcome at the end of the day.
When I'm standing up for something like this, I mean, that's a very challenging thing to do, and seeing it through. And is it a trait of yours?
If I see something that's wrong, I will speak up, or I will step in and voice my concerns. But it's not a trait that I go around and deliberately look for stuff like that. But if I'm involved in something and it's not working and I can see why, I will try to, you know, amend it, so to speak.
Horne Smythe, who runs Horsham Trails, among his many endeavours alongside his equine friends.